Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour from London. Here's what's coming up.
The coronavirus is hitting Spain hard now. The death toll overtakes China's, and the Spanish foreign minister joins me to explain desperate measures taken. Then, as US cases climb, hospitals need backup. Can the Veterans Administration fill this gap? I asked the former VA secretary, Dr. David Shulkin, and...
I'm anxious because the lockdown is working, right? So there is no more people getting infected. But when they open, what happened?
Hopes and fears as China's Hubei province relaxes its lockdown. Plus,
social distancing doesn't work for people in incarceration. There's no place for them to go.
In overcrowded, unsanitary cell blocks, the virus forces prisons around the world to release some inmates.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. It is only the end of the beginning of the coronavirus response, and already some leaders are getting testy about the lockdown medicine and its side effects, which is a global economic deep freeze. Populist leaders from places like Poland, Brazil, Mexico, and the United States starting to set short timelines for opening back their countries again. The U.S. Senate has finally agreed on a rescue package with the White House for workers and businesses, an unprecedented stimulus of $2 trillion. In Russia, where the virus was played down for a while, President Putin has now donned a hazmat suit and visited a hospital and pressing home a new warning. And in Europe, the current epicenter, the peak has yet to hit as confirmed cases rise. In the United Kingdom, the home of Keep Calm and Carry On, the crisis has hit home with heir to the throne Prince Charles testing positive. Meantime, Spain has now overtaken the Chinese death toll with more than 3,400 coronavirus deaths. The situation is so dire in the capital, Madrid, that an Olympic-sized ice rink has been converted into a morgue, and that was earlier this week. Now I'm joined by the Spanish Foreign Minister, Arantxa Gonzalez Laya. Foreign Minister, welcome to the program.
Hello.
So tell me, you see your cases climbing. I mean, almost overnight, there's been a reported increase of 10,000 new cases. What is the situation there, and how are you planning to try to get a grip on it, as they say, try to flatten the curve?
Well, we haven't yet reached the peak, which we hope will happen somehow by the end of this week, beginning of the next one. But we are confident that the measures we have taken on the health side, on the social side, will help us in flattening the curve. 47 million Spaniards have been asked to remain at home. Students are at home. Hospitals are taking care of the affected. The intensive care units are working at full speed. We've got a concentration of the problem in Madrid, in the region of Madrid. But we are confident, again, with the serious measures we have taken, we could see the curve flatten in the coming days. That's what we hope. That's what the entire nation is working for at the moment.
But that already is a forward projection, because your senior health official predicted that the peak might happen today. And instead, as you say, it's being pushed forward. And you're talking about desperate measures. It is, I mean, it's awful to say, but you have now overtaken Wuhan, the Chinese epicenter, in terms of number of Spaniards dead. What are you doing to try to deal with that? We've talked about an ice rink being converted as a morgue. What about your hospitals, your healthcare workers? Do they have the right equipment?
Well, what we have done is take very severe health measures. First, we have a solid healthcare system, which is obviously being put to the test, which in certain parts, especially in certain parts of the country where the coronavirus is hitting hardest, as I said, like in Madrid, like in the Basque Country, and now a little bit in Catalonia. What we have done is the most serious cases are treated in the hospitals, and the most serious of the most serious in the intensive care units. Those that are not severely affected infected remain at home and doctors treat them. They are providing the medicines and the care that they need in their homes. At the same time, we are taking very serious measures to ensure there is no physical contact, and through that we contain the contagion of the virus among the population. But again, it's every country will see a new record broken. Italy broke, China, we are coming after Italy, the U.S. is coming after us, Germany is coming after the U.S. It's a pandemic, and every country is having to cope with it. I only hope that what we are doing can serve, can help other countries that are coming after us in learning the good lessons of how to treat it. And for us, the good lesson is a solid healthcare system, very severe measures of isolation of the civilians, and obviously full equipment for the hospitals and the medical staff that are working flat out at the moment to help all our citizens in Spain.
So you're obviously playing up your healthcare system, but let's just repeat that overnight you've had a 27% increase in the death toll from Tuesday's figures. And as I said, you now stand at 50,000 infections, which is 10,000 more than what you reported yesterday. And talking about severe measures and lockdown, your parliament is debating whether you should continue it, because the first lockdown took place on March 14th and it's due to expire this Saturday. Will it continue? Do you expect the quarantine and the lockdown to continue?
Yes, there is a consensus in the country for the lockdown to continue for 2 more weeks. And we are doing this in full consensus of the political spectrum, talking with all our regions, talking with all the political parties in the country. The consensus is that we need to keep the lockdown because this is what is going to help us flatten the curve. But again, what is happening in Spain is not extraordinary. It's happening in every country. We have to see a peak before we see the curve flatten. For us, what is important now is to put all the energy of our 47 million citizens in an effort of citizenship with very heavy healthcare facilities working at full speed, to the objective of flattening the curve. It's a national struggle, what we are doing, and I'm confident that all of us rowing in the same direction will get there.
So let me ask you then, because you do tend to paint it as one big sort of global story, and yet different countries have taken different measures with different results. We've seen success in terms of draconian lockdown in China. We've seen it in terms of very heavy surveillance, testing and quarantining in Singapore. And we've seen Germany in Europe also have a very, very intense testing program, unlike other places. So while they have infections, they have relatively fewer deaths than, unfortunately, many other European countries, including your own. You say your health workers are protected, but here is what one of them has told our correspondent in Madrid, Scott McLean. Just listen, please.
No me sorprende en absoluto.
I'm not surprised at all, he says. In fact, I'm sure the numbers are higher because they don't test us. The protection measures are decreasing as we are running out of material. And now, well, we're using garbage bags.
You have to be pretty desperate to use a garbage bag as a medical gown.
He says it's a desperate measure, but it's better than nothing.
And Foreign Minister, 1 out of 10 confirmed cases of the virus are among medical workers in your country. That's the highest in Spain. I mean, what more do you have to do to protect these frontline warriors?
So we are protecting the frontline warriors. We are protecting them with equipment. We are protecting them with protocols. But it is, in a way, inevitable that a number of them get infected from treating the patient. Let's not forget that we are treating massive numbers, especially in one region. More than 50% of the cases in Spain are in Madrid. More than 75% of those deceased are over 80 years of age. We've got a concentration. It is terrible to see. It's human suffering. But we think again that with the measures we have taken, we are on course to beat the coronavirus and to flatten the curve. It's a huge effort. Every country, in a way, is learning about how to beat the virus by doing it. There is no magic recipe. Every country is having to, in a way, build on what the predecessors have done and struggle to find the right way to confront it. Some took it lightly in a way and said, okay, let's ensure there is a global, some sort of herd immunity, but by making sure people get a lot of contact. They also have had to change track. Some started with lighter confinement measures. They are having to take stronger measures. We are all in a test and trial effort to beat the virus. The most important thing, in my view, is to be determined and to follow very carefully all the recommendations that we are getting from the scientists, whether they are from the World Health Organization, the European scientists, or our own ones in Spain, making sure that the decisions we take for Spain are grounded in the science that we get from them.
Mm-hmm. And yet, that health worker told us that they have to wear garbage bags, Foreign Minister, to protect themselves while trying to protect and treat people. And this is important because you have this week, in fact, yesterday, reached out to NATO and asked for help. NATO, the military alliance, you've asked for help, requesting 1.5 million surgical masks, 500,000 rapid tests, nearly 500,000 respirators, and more than 500 mechanic ventilators. What is NATO? NATO is all your neighbors dealing with the same issues. What do you expect to get from them?
Well, what we are doing is purchasing material, and we have purchase worth of $500 million just in the last couple of days, worth of masks, worth of glasses, worth of testing, rapid testing kits, with lotions to make sure that our doctors are safe. All of this is what we have already purchased and more. And all this is getting to the healthcare system. But I cannot exclude that on this or that hospital or in this or that doctor, at times where the situation is very tight, they may have to make ends meet. But this is something that we are constantly looking at. We've got planes landing in Spain constantly with material coming from the four corners of this world, from China, from Turkey, from Sweden. And obviously, we have asked NATO, as it is our right to do, to see if they have a material that they could share with us. That is what allies do. There is nothing extraordinary in asking for it, although we know that some of our allies are fighting with exactly the same difficulties we are facing. So for us, what's important is, irrespective of where this material comes from, whether it's purchases that we have made, whether it's donations that we have gotten from our friends and allies, that we get the material to our doctors and nurses so that they can treat the patients.
So do you think then, because you're very, you know, you're very, very sharp about what allies do for each other, has this alliance, the Western alliance, European, NATO, the alliance, actually stepped up for each other? Do you feel that there's been enough? Because I know that you've signed a letter along with several other countries to get a much more, you know, pan-European response, a coordinated response as allies.
So we have, in my view, on the European side, we have gotten quite a good solidarity on the health side. There has been very clear protocols put in place by the European Commission to purchase for the entire European Union, rules to make sure that countries would not keep the products that they manufacture for themselves. So there has been quite a good sharing of the health material. We have also gotten the solidarity from outside the EU. We have gotten solidarity from China, just like China got solidarity from Spain when they needed it at the beginning of the coronavirus. But we think more can be done at the European level, not so much on the health side, but rather on the fiscal side, to make sure that as we fight the health battle, we lay the foundations for economic stability for when we have won the battle against coronavirus. Let's not forget that as we are fighting a health battle, we are also fighting an economic one. The economies of our world, not just Spain, not just Europe, but across the world, are coming close to a standstill simply because most citizens around the world are being asked to stay at home. Mm-hmm. This requires a more coordinated approach. That's what my Prime Minister, together with other European prime ministers, have asked the European leaders to undertake. more robust, more coordinated measures on the economic and fiscal side. And this is also the message that Prime Minister Sanchez will give at the meeting of G20 leaders, which he asked Saudi Arabia to convene, to make sure that robustness and cooperation is not just European, it has to be global, because our economy is a global one.
Mm-hmm. Just let me ask you about this letter, because it's obviously to try to get a more sort of common debt instrument to help, you know, in the future. And you've said alongside France, Portugal, Greece, Italy, Belgium, Ireland, Luxembourg, you all signed it, and you're asking about this thing, which has been a long time disagreement between you and other European countries about setting up a common debt mechanism. Now, Germany did not sign this letter. Are you speaking directly to Germany and to the other powerful economies that may not have signed this?
Yes, we are. And we think that unlike in the past, when we have been toying with this idea, this time is different. This time is not about virtuous countries and those that are very spendthrift. It's not like the 2008 crisis. This is a systemic crisis. It's caused by a global pandemic. So what we need is a mechanism of solidarity, some sort of mutualization of our debt, not the overall debt, but the debt that we are incurring today to face coronavirus. So what we are saying is the circumstances today would require the European response to be more robust in terms of mutualizing our debt, but not the debt in the abstract. It's the debt we are incurring mm-hmm. to face this pandemic called coronavirus that is affecting all our economies. So this is not 2008. This is 2020, and we are all in it. It's a systemic shock we are going through.
I just want to read from the op-ed that you put into the Washington Post today, speaking of a crisis of governance. Globalization has deepened our economic links, but our tools to govern them have not. We live in a world of dazzling new technologies, and yet our global governance mechanisms are blatantly outdated. What are you trying to fix there?
What we're trying to fix is we've got a global economy, we've got a global issue like climate change, we've got global inequality, we've got global technology, we now have a global pandemic. Maybe this is the wake-up call. But the tools that we have to fight these global issues are not global in reality. A lot of it is still national, and a lot of it is cooperation at the international level that lies on the goodwill of countries. So what we are saying is, why don't we use the fact that this year, 2020, is the 75th anniversary of the United Nations, this amazing instrument of global cooperation that we built 75 years ago when we had a huge systemic shock called Second World War. Why don't we use this moment to recreate this tighter system of global cooperation? Why don't we use this moment to reform our system of global governance, our system of international cooperation? Why don't we look at how can we rejig the United Nations for the benefit of addressing these global challenges that we have? This pandemic is a huge wake-up call for all of us in terms of giving ourselves the means globally, in a cooperated manner, to fight a global challenge that knows no border, that knows no passport, called coronavirus.
Let me just finally ask you to get back to the victims, you know, because we don't see so much the victims in this invisible invader. We see the economy, we talk about the healthcare workers, there are a lot of briefings, a lot of leaders. But those who are suffering and dying are not really as visible as they might be in a war or an earthquake or something like that. And we were quite shocked and touched that in Spain there was a story of an elderly care home or a nursing home in which the care workers had fled. They had fled and left the elderly people and the sick people there. And it took, I believe, the military searching for what was going on to find these bodies left there. I mean, what does that say?
Exactly. One of the lessons we need to draw when we finish with coronavirus is we have to have a relook at what we are doing to care for our elderly. This virus is affecting our elderly in a vicious manner. More than 90% of those that have lost their lives in Spain are over 70 of age. What system do we have to help them? This is not a question that is only limited to Spain. I see this in Italy. I see this in France. I see this in the UK, and I see this in the US. So we're going to have a look at what society are we that in a way, us not paying enough attention to our elderly people. They are the casualties of this war. We don't see them. But all I can tell you, Christian, is that here in Spain, we feel very strongly about them, and we are discovering that maybe we have not been paying enough attention to their needs and to their care. And that is one of the lessons, one of the many lessons, together with the need to invest in public health, that we will have to draw once we have won the war against coronavirus.
Let us hope that does come out of this tunnel. Foreign Minister Arantxa Gonzalez Laya, thank you so much for joining me from Spain tonight. And now to the U.S., where hospitals are struggling in light of massive demand. But in New York, the country's epicenter, Governor Andrew Cuomo said that evidence suggests social distancing does reduce that pressure. Take a listen.
This past Sunday, the projection was that hospitalizations were doubling every 2 days, okay? On Monday, the numbers suggested that the hospitalizations were doubling every 3.4 days. On Tuesday, the projection suggested that the hospitalizations were doubling every 4.7 days. Now, that is almost too good to be true. But the theory is, given the density that we're dealing with, it spreads very quickly. But if you reduce the density, you can reduce the spread very quickly.
So social distancing works, but right now it's still not working fast enough for the overstretched facilities and resources. The Veterans Administration is the designated backup in times of crisis as the single largest healthcare provider in the United States. But is it even ready for this influx? Joining me now from Philadelphia with answers is Dr. David Shulkin. He is the former Secretary of Veteran Affairs. Welcome to the program, Dr. Shulkin.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So there are lots of questions to answer from what Governor Cuomo said about the social distancing and the hospitalization, from what the Spanish foreign minister said about the elderly and the need to take care of them and put them front and center. What about the Veterans Administration's ability to step in? It is the first line of defense when it's necessary. Do you think that is going to happen? And does it need to happen now in the U.S.?
I think that the Department of Veteran Affairs trains for this mission. Its primary mission, of course, is to care for the veterans in this country, but it also has a mission to be there in times of national emergency, which, of course, the president has declared this a national emergency. It has more than 1,000 facilities throughout the country. In many parts of the country where veterans live in rural areas, it's one of the only healthcare providers. And it has more than 350,000 employees who work in its healthcare system. Even in today's stimulus package that was passed by the Senate, the VA gets $19.6 billion in additional funding. So this is a very, very large organization that's national in scope. And it really needs to be part of a solution to make sure that all citizens in the country get the necessary and available resources that are available.
So do you think, A, that nearly $20 billion is sufficient to cover veterans and their health issues? Because obviously they're mostly elderly and many of them have underlying, of course, medical conditions. But also the draft suggests that the government would repay the VA for whatever it lays out. In other words, it seems to be like a first step before reaching out and asking you to join the fight, or asking the VA to join the fight.
Yeah, the American people have always been extremely generous to supporting the VA because of its mission to take care of our veterans. I do not believe that any of the issues with the VA reaching in and coordinating and helping at a community by community level are going to be financial. They're going to be a shortage of staff that the VA has itself, and the ability to make sure that it can take care of veterans as a primary mission. But hospitals are losing lots of money at this point across the country. The stimulus package also provided some support, about $100 billion for the rest of the U.S. healthcare system. I think the VA is in a strong position with the supplies that they have and the capabilities that they have to be able to be part of the solution for all Americans.
So let's just recall, and maybe you can help Americans realize what you actually do. I mean, you've played significant and often vital roles in recent years. You know, Puerto Rico after the hurricane, all sorts of other situations, including providing mobile units not many years ago when there was a mass shooting in the United States. Just tell people what extra services you could provide.
Well, I think the VA trains for this mission of emergency preparedness, and most often it is natural disasters like hurricanes, snowstorms, and other types of weather events that VA steps in and deploys its staff and opens up extra facilities to help out. But when I was running the VA healthcare system, the nightclub shooting that happened in Orlando, Florida, occurred, and that looked like it was a terrible situation. So I deployed to the civilian population our mobile units. VA runs special mobile units that can bring medical personnel to a site where a disaster has occurred. And we helped more than 5,500 potential patients and their families over the next couple of days in Orlando, Florida. So there is precedent where VA has stepped in. We've never seen a situation like this. And I think VA is really capable of doing a lot more than people realize to be part of the solution.
So you're not just a former administrator of this VA, but you're also a doctor, Dr. David Shulkin. So I want to ask your medical advice, because this is now getting very confusing. You have the president and some other world leaders who just are very, very, very antsy right now about the economic impact. The president saying we don't want the cure to be worse than the problem. And saying perhaps we might be open and churches and services and this and that by Easter. And you've had similar statements coming from Brazil and from Mexico and et cetera. What is your view on that? Because they're saying that you could protect the most vulnerable, i.e. the elderly and the sick, and allow the rest of the country to go back to its business. Is that possible medically?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. I think that's a very hopeful position that President Trump and others have taken, but I think it's very unrealistic. When you take a look at the trajectory of the growth of infections in Europe and now in the United States, we are still quite a while away before that this peaks in the United States, probably 10 to 12 days behind Europe. And there are going to be a lot of people that are additionally infected and unfortunately a number that will die and certainly be hospitalized because of that. So I think that the primary goal here is to fight the virus, to fight the infection. This is going to be solved through addressing the public health needs. I think the economic consequences, with the impact on people with social isolation and stopping their normal daily activities, should not be overlooked. Those are going to be quite significant consequences. But the only way to deal with this and for us to get through this is to deal with the health issues first. And that's going to require some additional sacrifice with continued social distancing, quarantining. There may be some pockets of the country where if we do extensive testing and there is not community spread, they may have some exceptions. But I think that it is highly unlikely that this pandemic is going to spare many parts of the United States.
So can you also explain to me what is the problem with releasing federal stockpiles of vitally needed things like ventilators? You've heard the New York governor, who sits right at the, you know, the epicenter of where it is in New York, in the U.S. right now, and expecting a peak in a couple of weeks, and is calling on the federal government to release its stockpiles because they just don't have enough. What would be the problem with doing that? Why not do that?
It should be done. There's absolutely no reason why it should be done. I think that Governor Cuomo is a very articulate spokesperson on this right now. The country should be sending its resources to where it's needed now. And When we can deal with that issue, then we should move those resources to where it will be needed next. These supplies, ventilators, and other equipment have no purpose sitting in warehouses. They need to be distributed. I do believe that that message has been heard, that we are beginning to move those supplies and equipment to places that are needed. But there is no question that they're going to be needed most in areas like New York, California, Washington State. And then once those patients are addressed, those equipment and supplies can be moved around to other places in the country.
Now, I want to ask you another thing, because, you know, we have had now the last 4 years around the world of essentially discrediting and discarding expert advice. Various leaders, for whatever political reason, I can't imagine, seem to throw away expert, medical, scientific, fact-based advice from trusted sources. And there is a small element in the United States which is now ganging up on Dr. Fauci, Anthony Fauci, who, by the way, only discovered, you know, the AIDS virus. So he has a major role to play, clearly, in this. And they're sort of ganging up on him as if he's being some kind of a scaremonger. How dangerous is that if he is silenced?
I think that this has been a wake-up call for people around the world, and certainly for Americans that have discarded the importance and the role of government. With all of the political games and the partisanship that we've seen in Washington in recent years, people have gotten disgusted with government. But it is a time of crisis like this that they are seeing, and they recognize the very unique and essential role that government can play. And in a time of crisis, what you need to rely upon are people with competence, experience, who can help really provide answers and lead us through this. And in recent years, there has been a tendency to discard the career people who have been expert and working on issues, to not understand the importance of the work of government. But this is the role of government, to respond for the safety of its citizens. And we usually think about that in terms of defense, such as defending in a military situation. But in this situation, you can see the importance of having competent people who understand how to deal with pandemics. Mm-hmm. I myself, I left the private sector after running hospitals throughout my career, being a physician, to go to government to help straighten out the situation in the Department of Veteran Affairs. And I experienced how tough it is to focus on the job, to get the work done, to focus on what you know works. I ended up writing a book about this called It Shouldn't Be This Hard to Serve Your Country, for exactly what I think Dr. Fauci is experiencing now, which is it's a tough place to operate, but you have to stand for your principles. You have to continue to advocate what you believe in. You do not yield to the political pressures, because people's lives are at stake, and people like Dr. Fauci and other very serious health professionals understand that very well.
And I can see the book behind you. Thank you for mentioning it, because I was going to in this regard, because Politico is also reporting, and this is kind of worrying, that under the Trump administration, the Department of Homeland Security stopped its annual practice of running detailed pandemic simulations, which would inform a public and government response, like war and all the other games that people do. We also know that the White House fired the government's entire pandemic response chain of command at CDC, at the National Security Council. Why would they do that, and what are the ramifications?
I don't think until you go through something like this that people appreciate that planning and being prepared is an important role in government. If you look at our military, they do a lot of war exercises. They don't do that because they're bored. They do that because they know, they understand that should they be called upon, they better know what they're doing and they better be coordinated. And that is the case in every other part of government, where you have to take seriously what you do in a situation like this. And so while it's not sexy, and while it seems like you can move money around or people around and not do things that aren't needed, it is an essential role of government to be prepared. Mm-hmm. And so fortunately, there are people who are in our government who have been through situations, who are experienced. And now more than ever, we have to rely upon them to step up and to show us the way so that we can work our way through this crisis.
All right. Dr. Shulkin, thank you so much. And of course, Dr. Fauci, as brilliant as he is, pioneered the treatments for AIDS rather than having discovered the virus. But nonetheless, that is huge. Thank you so much indeed. Now, what we do know is the pattern of this virus across the globe ever since it broke out in China, and there perhaps some light at the end of the tunnel. Today, for the first time since locking down 2 months ago, Hubei province is relaxing the draconian restrictions, hoping to extend that to the city of Wuhan itself by early April. But anxiety does linger among some residents, as David Culver now reports.
At the original epicenter of the novel coronavirus in Wuhan, China, there is now a countdown to freedom for those living under lockdown, with Hubei province relaxing restrictions starting Wednesday and its capital, Wuhan, set to relax its rules on April 8th.
I think it's really amazing. Finally, I've been at home for 2 months.
PhD student Della Epifania video chatted with us from her cramped dormitory. It's been 2 months under Wuhan City lockdown. Her life, like an increasing number of us, requiring a creative balance.
But if you try to see it in the positive way, that you get to rest, you get to try to cook, maybe you can learn how to cook more, or you can exercise at home.
She's been doing all of that, working out, indoors, lots of cooking, plenty of eating.
I can't stop eating.
Watching movies and keeping connected with her family back in Indonesia. While excited to see signs of progress, she's also hesitant about stepping back out into the city.
I'm anxious because the lockdown is working, right? So there is no more people getting infected. But when they open, now what happened?
Chinese state media shows images of Wuhan preparing for that moment. Intercity traffic checkpoints coming down. Buses disinfected, gearing up for the return to rush hour. Sanitation crews working to clean mass transit centers like the Wuhan railway station. And medical teams like this Shanghai-based crew packing up to head home, leaving the front lines. It's reassuring for residents like Iris Yu. I was not always positive, she told us. I could also get bored and scared, but I'm particularly thankful to my friends in other cities where the epidemic situation was not as serious. They often called me and chatted with me, which could help ease my emotions. When we first touched base with Bo Hanlon a few weeks ago, both his wife and mother were undergoing treatment for the virus. And Bo was critical of the local government's handling of the crisis. But now... Because the condition is under control, the supplies have kept up, he says. Life is fine now. I can't go out, but overall, it's getting better and better. And so, too, are his wife and mother. He says both have since fully recovered. These residents have been living under some of the most extreme lockdown measures, and they now offer some advice to others around the world entering self-isolation.
Yeah, maybe it's God saying, like, okay, I clear up everything. Your schedule, your classes, your work, you cannot do anything, you stay inside, so maybe you can talk to God.
She and others left with a lot of time for talking and listening.
And I guess we're all sitting on the edge of our seats, hoping that when Hubei does relax, this virus will not return. Now, some governments have been forced to release thousands of prisoners. Last week, Iran released 85,000, and it's also happening across the United States. And the UK is also considering doing the same. New Jersey has already announced it's releasing up to 1,000 low-risk inmates to curb the coronavirus spread in overcrowded and often unsanitary prisons. Lawrence Bartley is director of the Marshall Project's News Inside. It's a newspaper written for inmates. And he tells our Hari Srinivasan on Zoom what this crisis means for the world's invisible population.
Lawrence Bartley, thanks for joining us. First, I want to ask, what are you hearing from prisoners inside about coronavirus, the stories that they have or how they're living with this?
Unfortunately, I'm hearing a lot. They are suffering from a lack of information. They are fear, they're panic stricken. They're worried about their family members because they have communication, but communication is limited in some places. The rules are different, but a lot of them are concerned with the fact that they don't have the adequate cleaning supplies in comparison to us on the outside to prepare themselves or protect themselves against this virus.
And what happens when they hear that there are either jail guards that have fallen sick or other prisoners that might be?
Well, one person in particular, he reached out to me and he said that he wished that the facility would have these thermal guns in which they can check the temperatures of guards coming in, because they don't have it. Only the staff members have it, and staff members are coming in, and they're hearing, seeing reports on the news that people in different facilities, staff members who have contracted this disease, and they're afraid that they'll get it.
When people think of prisoners, they can't practice social distancing. There is no freedom of movement. There is no opportunity to stay 6 feet away.
Right. Let me paint a picture for you. Many prisoners live in dorms, and their bunks are right next to each other, and they have people on top of them like a bunk bed. So there isn't any social distancing. Some facilities have closed jobs and programs. You know, they have regular jobs going around, cleaning up jobs or maintenance jobs in the facilities that are canceled. So people are staying in their dorm areas. Even those who are in a cell, there's a metal wall or separating them, but it's close. And the front of the gates are open so people can talk and they can sneeze and they even cough out. And you know that cough and sneezing particles stay in the air for quite a long period of time. And this virus can survive on surfaces for quite a long period of time. And so social distancing doesn't work for people in incarceration. There's no place for them to go. So this virus can pass on very easily if we are not super careful.
You said you've had prisoners reach out to you. What kind of stories are they telling you?
Oh, they're telling me stories about not knowing. Like, there haven't been, like, for Mississippi, for instance, you know, there are, for some states, are severely understaffed. They're underpopulated. When the economy is doing well, people don't want to take prison guard jobs. So they have less people to even working in prison, so less people to write memos, to let the incarcerated population know, all right, visits are going to be shut down. Whereas they had to just hear it from word of mouth that visits are going to be shut down today because of the coronavirus. Many of them only get their information through watching TV or listening to the radio. And then the information they get might be geared towards the public at large or a different state, but not personalized to their individual state. So they simply don't know. And they can't get the adequate cleaning supplies like Purell or the hand sanitizers that we're used to having. So and a lot of facilities and states have outlawed or outruled bleach because they think that people will use bleach as a weapon. But I'm hearing now that they're allowing some semblance of watered down bleach to come into the units to clean the showers and bathrooms. But many of the people have to share little chips of soap in which they use to wash their hands. In one facility, a man told me there's 5 sinks that 60 people use, and they have 5 sections next to the sink with chips of soap. And all of them have to share using those chips of soap, 60 people. And they worry about whether that is healthy enough.
Mm. And you also had a story about a New York corrections officer getting sick.
Yes, a New York correction officer in Sing Sing unfortunately came down with the coronavirus. And what everyone should know that the walls are not only meant to keep people in, meant to keep information from getting out and from information getting in. So we have reports of someone who was a correction officer that contracted it, but we don't know where that person worked within the facility, where that person was in close contact with the incarcerated population. And so we don't know. We even heard that there's someone in an ICE detention facility in Elizabeth, New Jersey, who has a reputation to be one of the most dirtiest facilities in the country, that there's a guard that tests positive for it as well. So the problem just increases.
The Marshall Project, for people who don't know, is a nonprofit newsroom focused on criminal justice stories, criminal justice reform stories. You also recently had a map that you published that showed how different states were dealing with, say, visitation rights. What are the different methods that states are using?
Well, a lot of states are closing visits from family members and friends. Some of them are even not allowing attorney visits, but they are letting staff come in. But, you know, people who are incarcerated, people on the outside, are their lifelines. The phones is like one step. The visits are the second step. And the greatest step is the extended family visits where people can spend the night with their family members for about 48 hours. And not to have that, that's traumatizing for someone who's incarcerated, but anyone incarcerated, but speaking for those who have did a 180 from their criminal ways and want to make a change and want to be loving fathers, brothers, and sons. Mm-hmm. And this kind of cripples their ability to stay in contact with this same fear of not knowing what family members are going through. But prison administrators have to protect them and have to protect everyone else from catching the virus. So many people incarcerated who have reached out to me via email, via call, via letters, they all understand.
Do you think that there is a different level of care or attention paid to members of the prison staff versus the prisoners themselves?
Absolutely. Prisoners who have symptoms of the flu are quarantined in some states, but none of them are telling me that they're tested for corona. And I'm hearing in the news that their reports just coming out that they finally got the testing kits for people on the outside. So, you know, civilians are going to be tested first. But people who are inside largely believe they are an invisible population, that no one really cares about them. They're exiled because they did something bad. But for those who, like for instance, like me, I was incarcerated at the age of 17. I did 27 years and 2 months. And I was, for over two decades, I haven't been the person I was who committed a crime in the first place. So I didn't see myself as someone who is the lowest of the low. I always wanted to be included. I always wanted to be seen as equal as a person. So when time like this, where testing kits are going around and those testing kits are not being provided to the people who are incarcerated, you know, they feel even more less than, and they worry about if they'll be potentially be forgotten enough to be sacrificed, you know. So all these kind of fearful thoughts will swirl around in their heads.
So Lawrence, what sent you inside?
Well, unfortunately, at the age of 16, I was shot 4 times in a drive-by shooting. Before that, my parents had got divorced. I had moved from a middle-class neighborhood to more of an urban one, one where crime was the order of the day. It was a time where, you know, crack had influenced my neighborhood greatly. And, you know, there was no trust for police officers back then. And after being shot, I knew I couldn't go to police officers because they were preying on my community. So in order to keep myself safe, I did something stupid and I ended up getting a gun. And the gun was my sort of security. I had no intention of using it. But, in New York City in 1990, at the time I got arrested, New York had 2,242 murders by gun violence. So that's the time I was living in. So I figured this gun would be my security. And a few friends and myself went to a movie theater. And, you know, I had the gun on me that night. And another group of teens came in making a lot of noise. They were arguing with a couple of the other patrons. And one of my friends told them to be quiet. And then they started yelling back and forth at us. And one of those individuals pulled out a gun and fired at us. And people in my section, my group of friends included, pulled out guns and started firing back. I fired 1 time. And I didn't see anyone in front of me. I didn't think anyone was there. I just wanted to fire in order to retreat. And I wanted to fire in order to be accepted. And I wanted to fire in order to be safe. And all that was going through the mind of a 17-year-old at the time. And I made the wrong choice. And at the end, 4 people were injured and 1 person was killed. And I was sentenced to 27 and 30 years to life.
So after you finish your 27 years, you built a newspaper that is delivered into prisons. Tell me about News Inside.
Well, News Inside is an idea I had, you know, when I was incarcerated, you know, I went to the parole board, you know, 5 times in 7 months. I had a series of appeals that got me before the parole board, and I finally won my release. And I wrote an article about all the psychological trauma I went through and balancing that with the way I felt compassion for the victim's family and how it played on the incarcerated individuals and myself. And that led me to earn a job at the Marshall Project. And when I got to the Marshall Project, I looked at this this treasure of stories that we had in our data in our, on our website that's about criminal justice, because that's what we do. We report on criminal justice news. And I thought that, wow, if people incarcerated had an opportunity to view these stories, it could not only be of a benefit to them mentally, it can change their lives, because I call these news you can use. People can use this. And so I pitched an idea, you know, to put our work in print and distribute it all over the country, because people incarcerated don't have access to the internet like you and I. And luckily it worked. And I promised the Marshall Project, if they allow me to do this in 1 year, I will guarantee that I will have them into 10 states and 20 facilities. But within 1 year's time, we are in 38 states and 502 facilities, and I'm really proud of it.
So using News Inside, you launch a survey between the Marshall Project and Slate. Why was it important to find the political opinions of prisoners?
Well, because, for one, when I was incarcerated, you know, I told you I did 27 years, I began to, you know, think about my situation over and over, and I knew that it was limited powers that a judge had to release me after all my appeals was exhausted. And I knew that the only way I could get out early is if with some form of legislative action. So I began to pay attention. And so I knew that people who were in a situation and I was would pay attention to what's going on legislatively in their states and maybe what's going on a national election stage. And they were left out of it. You know, many states, people incarcerated can't vote. Only states where everyone incarcerated can vote is Maine and Vermont. Mm-hmm. And there's states like Florida who just passed Amendment 4, allowing people who are formerly incarcerated to vote for the first time, even though they're trying to repeal that through mm-hmm. saying you can't vote unless you pay fines and fees. But I knew that people incarcerated had something to say and they had opinion. And I just wondered, just what if they were allowed to vote? You know what I mean? What would this country look like? So I put a survey inside News Inside with Slate and my colleagues, Nicole Lewis and Anna Flagg helped me out with it tremendously. And we got back over 8,000 responses and counting. And usually national polls have about 400 to 1,000 responses. So I feel really proud that what we have is something that's very unique.
I want to ask you about the Zoe. This is something that the Marshall Project partnered with Topic on. What is it?
The Zoe is a phrase that was coined by someone who was incarcerated, and he called it the Twilight Zone, and he called it the Zoe for short to represent the psychological imbalance that a person who is incarcerated faces on a day-to-day basis. It's not always linked to violence. It could be linked to not having to not going to the school building at the same time every day, not getting the adequate amount of sheets, not one rule. The rule could be one thing one day, this is approved one day, but the next day it can be illegal and a person can subject him or herself to solitary confinement as a result of it. So that's basically the zone.
I mean, we've got different stories in there. One of them was what was called the drive-by. We might play a quick clip.
Inmates are supposed to be awake to catch the list by telling the officer where he or she intends to go during the day. In most facilities, the officer taking the list speeds by in the dark while people in their cells routinely state,
"Mess hall, yard, school, vocational, hospital,"
as the officer looks straight ahead and robotically records each person's request. If you are still asleep or hesitate and therefore miss the Zoom by a nanosecond, you are out of luck.
It's something that we just take for granted, just having some semblance of, well, control over our schedules, certainly, but just what is and what isn't true from day to day, what does that do to you psychologically?
Like you just mentioned the drive-by, you know, when a person has to, there's five counts a day. One of them happens at 5:30 in the morning, and a person is asleep. Like everyone, a lot of people are asleep at 5:30, and a person has to be up when an officer robotically walked by, taking a list, asking a person where he's going to go to the day. Person slips one time, that person can be subject to a misbehavior report that will follow him or her all the way to the parole board, might be 5, 10, 20 years later. And that can be torture, you know?
Lawrence Bartley, Director of News Inside, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ari.
So interesting. And of course, the Marshall Project is a nonprofit news organization dedicated to covering the U.S. criminal justice system. And finally, as cases of coronavirus continue to surge, so too does a troubling habit among some world leaders, reverting to the old tropes of denial, conspiracy theories, and media bashing. Brazil's right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro, is calling coronavirus a little flu overhyped by the media that's tricking the people. Mexico's left-wing president, Manuel Obrador, is actually encouraging his people to hug and to eat out, while political rallies continue in Nicaragua. And President Donald Trump says that he wants to open up America again for Easter, despite health expert warnings. Let us just remember that so far the evidence shows that two things have worked to flatten this curve: strict isolation, social distancing and lockdown, as in China, and properly identifying, testing and quarantining of the infected, as in Singapore. So we here will continue to follow and report the facts and the best practices. We'll continue to rely on time-tested, true situations and institutions and those that are credible. So look out for the innovative and effective view from Denmark. We'll bring you that later this week. That's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.